This is Michael Leary from the Human Research Protection Office at Washington University in St. Louis with More Than Meets the IRB. More Than Meets the IRB is a series of conversations dedicated to research participants and the people who study them. At More Than Meets the IRB, we often talk about the past and present of research ethics. Today, we are going to turn toward the future. As the much-anticipated revisions to the basic regulations guiding human subjects research are becoming a reality, ethicists, regulators, and administrators are full of questions. Will there be any substantive changes? How will the regulations meet the needs of emerging sciences? Will there be any special attention paid to social and behavioral research? This is probably the most fertile time for IRB-related conversation since the regulations were initially implemented in the late 1980s. We are excited today to have two guests that have been at the forefront of this conversation in the past few years. I'd like to welcome I. Glenn Cohen, Professor of Law, Harvard Law School, and Faculty Director, Petrie Flom Center for Health Law Policy, Biotechnology, and Bioethics, and Holly Fernandez Lynch, Executive Director of the Petrie Flom Center on Health Law Policy, Biotechnology, and Bioethics. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
And you are co-editors of the recent Human Subjects Research and Regulation, Perspectives on the Future, which was published by MIT Press in 2014. Can you talk a little bit about this important volume, which is a collection of essays covering the state of the art in conversation on key themes in human subjects regulation? So how did this volume come about? What are some of the key arguments and innovations readers will encounter in these essays?
Our center every year picks what we think is the hot topic in health law, bioethics, and biotechnology. And for the year in which we did the conference, the AMPRM had been recently announced, and we thought it was the hot topic for discussion. At the time when we had the conference, it usually takes a little bit of a lag time to get a book out, we lived in fear that the ANPRM would be released and our volume would not have an opportunity to kind of shape the process and give ideas, but it turns out that here we are sometime after the release of the book, and still the ANPRM is not out. And the book really kind of invited leading thinkers in the area to suggest and react to the ANPRM and give reactions in terms of things that areas where it did well, where it did badly. And Holly can say a bit about some of the topics that were covered in the book.
So the book is divided into a couple of different sections. We have some authors who are focusing on the regulation of risk and the way in which regulatory oversight should be related to the risks that are posed to research participants. Then we have a couple of authors who are focused on the protection of vulnerable populations, including military personnel, pediatric communities, and prison populations. Then we have a section devoted to rethinking the participant-researcher relationship and the role of IRBs, thinking about, for example, ways in which as patients and research subjects start to look more like participants, does that have a role in the way IRBs should work, right? So if patients are becoming actively engaged in designing research or helping shape research questions, do they need to be protected as much as they traditionally have been by IRBs? Then we have a section on specimens, data, and privacy. And I think that's probably emerged as the hottest topic. And there's really just a lot of different perspectives on the appropriate way to do research on biospecimens, whether consent is necessary from the sources of those specimens every time they're used for research, for example. And then the last section of the book focuses on paradigm shifts in research ethics. And so this was an idea that we had where we asked authors, if you could sort of start from scratch, if you weren't bound by the system we currently have, what type of system would you build? And then we had some discussion about whether social and behavioral research ought to be regulated differently or similarly to clinical research, medical research, some questions about whether IRBs are able to deal with the heterogeneity of research participants and what they might be interested or the protections they might want for themselves. And then we have a chapter by Greg Kosky, sort of the last chapter of the book, and he was asking a really basic question. Do we need to keep regulating research as though investigators are all bad actors? And I thought that was a really important question to ask, given that, you know, the regulations we have were born out of scandal.
Yeah. And one thing I really like about the book, if, you know, I'm a little self-serving, but I like about the book is that it's a real mix of methodologies. We've got political philosophers, we've got scientists, we've got empirical. We even have somebody who did a qualitative kind of anthropological take where she spent time with a certain number of IRBs over a series of years kind of in the wild and examine the way in which they rely on local precedent. Mm-hmm. That's Laura Stark's chapter in the book, which is really fascinating to go inside the IRB, like going inside a jury almost.
It is. We've spoken with Laura Stark several times about her work, which, as you say, is fascinating. I think one of the remarkable things about this volume is that it demonstrates this conversation about human research regulations is an actual academic discipline in its own right. And perhaps part of the shortcomings or some of the failures of the way regulations have been applied is this lack of academic focus, or as the book describes it, potentially this lack of any kind of empirical basis for conversation about how the regulations could change or shift in the future. Can you talk a bit about that in terms of this point that the book makes, in part, that the regulations are not empirically based? The way that IRBs do things is often born out of local precedent, and there's much variability between IRBs for that reason. What are some of the things that are happening out there that will lead us to the creation or implementation of better regulation?
So I think that's exactly right. One of the great ironies is you have a system designed to facilitate the empirical study of human behaviors and drugs and stuff like that, and it itself is not empirically rigorously tested or based. And as you say, there's a huge amount of heterogeneity. From things starting with the discussion of what is human subjects research, so the question of what is exempt versus non. Here I think the ANPRM has an attempt to kind of clarify a little bit the borders between exempt versus non-exempt research and also render more exempt. That's my take on it. To the question of the orchestration and running of multi-center trials and really everything in between. There's a lot of variability, but the variability is often not conscious. As you say, a lot of it develops over time and is kind of like barnacles within a particular IRB where they say, well, we had a protocol like this 5 years ago and this is what we did, so we should do it again, without asking the questions of the way we regulated it really happens.
Yes.
And I often think about this a lot more like common law reasoning, or maybe more like constitutional law reasoning. Just as the U.S. Constitution, as compared to, let's say, the South African or Canadian or Indian Constitution, is incredibly short, terse, and unclear document, so the common rule is, and a lot of the pressure to interpret it then filters down to individual decision makers, the courts in the case of the Constitution, and the IRBs in the case, as well as other institutional officials in the case of research ethics.
Yeah, so I would just add, I think the lack of empirical data about how the regulations are effectuating their goals or not effectuating their goals is a really big problem, but empirical data can't answer all of the questions that we might have about human subjects research regulation. So I think we need sort of a combination of conceptual and empirical analysis, right? So on the conceptual side, we just have a fundamental question about the balance between protecting research participants and advancing important research. That is not a question that empiricists can answer, right? But if we want to say that the goal of the regulations is to protect subjects, to protect research participants, there are a lot of empirical questions we can ask about how well IRBs and investigators and OHRP and other regulatory oversight agencies are doing. Definitely there are a lot of people in different fields who have made human subjects research ethics their life's work. There's also a discipline emerging in the legal academy, though, on empirical legal studies, right? Are laws and regulations doing what they were intended to do, and how would we ask those questions, and how would we know? As Glenn mentioned, this is kind of meta, right? Because to do that analysis, you might need IRB review in the first place. Glenn and I are working on a project now where we're trying to evaluate how IRBs and other stakeholders understand the concepts of coercion and undue influence, mm-hmm. which are terms that come up, or undue inducement, terms that come up in the research regulations that are not defined. And to do that empirical work, we had to go through the IRB and make amendments and, you know, have a consent process when we're actually studying IRB members and investigators. So it's really interesting and challenging.
Sounds like many of these conversations are trickling down from academic movements in the legal field, but also they're increasing in as our awareness of practices in transnational contexts also grows. As we see how other people do things, we start thinking more self-reflectively about how the regulations work here in the U.S. Does that sound fair?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I will say that the ANPRM process has been interesting in its own right, as I think it was kind of floated as a balloon, as the ANPRM was supposed to be. And usually, though, it's a pretty good roadmap where the responsible agency wants to go. In this case, I think there was so much response and so much commentary to the ANPRM that it put OHRP and the administration in a little bit of a quandary as to what to do next. And, you know, Holly and I hear scuttlebutt, it's coming next month, and then a month goes by and we don't see anything. You know, we're
getting, and a year goes by
and we don't see anything. So yeah. I think there is a real question, what will be the end product of this? It's not outside the bounds of possibilities that nothing emerges from this process, which I think would be too bad, but would be kind of interesting also academically why that's the case.
But, you know, the question is, are we stuck with it? Because it's so difficult to get people to agree on how it ought to be changed, right? I mean, the key things that the ANPRM covered, bioassessment research with, you know, existing data, how the consent process should take place, these are really fundamental challenges for research ethics, and reasonable people are all over the map on how, you know, their perspectives on these questions.
Let's head that direction toward discussing some of these concepts and concerns in the context of tissue and data collection, which is a field of research that's so intriguing because it raises really all of these questions at the same time. The lines between clinical care and our daily use of utilities like the internet and research, they've become really blurry. There have been several recent high-profile conversations about the use of data and tissue in research, such as the Cornell Facebook study, which we talked about here a few times on our program. It highlighted growing concerns about the availability of our data to researchers and the way that they use it, and also the Havasupai Tribe case and recent editorial on 23andMe suggest concern about genetic research and the nature of consent in that field. So what do you see in the future for the collection of data and tissue for research? Where are research ethics and a regulation headed relative to these questions?
One thing that I think your question poses, to me at least, is the increasingly obvious asymmetry, by the way, in which research is regulated at federally funded institutions versus private corporations, right? That when data becomes the coin of the realm, you have a system whereby the Harvards of the world have to go through huge amounts of review, huge amounts of care, calibrate how they use data, how they inform people of things. The Facebooks of the world, at least when they're acting in their own capacity, sometimes when universities are involved, it's a little more complicated, do not, right, and are running experiments in a willy-nilly sort of way. This particular asymmetry, the ANPRM only gets at it very slightly in that, as you know, there is this phrase, checking the box, that most institutions that receive federal funding and therefore apply the common rule to their federally funded research also check the box to apply it beyond federally funded research. And the ANPRM, as I understand it, and Holly, correct me if I get this wrong, would basically say, no, all your research will de facto be covered by the common rule.
If you're getting federal funding. Yeah.
But that now will still cleave off the Facebooks of the world, right? So Harvard, when doing non-federally funded, Harvard already checks the box, in my impression, all the time. But all universities will be doing one thing, but the Facebooks of the world will be doing something else. And as a data scientist, for example, who's really interested in these techniques and doing this kind of work, if you have a decision to go somewhere where you're going to have to face IRB review, you're going to have to face the infrastructure, you're going to face limitations on what you could do, or go to the private sector where you don't, I could imagine it might be quite enticing to you to go to the private sector. So this is a problem, I think, and that my own view is that both are research, both have the power to adversely affect individuals, either at the dignitary level or on a day-to-day level, and yet the system treats them as completely different. But this particular distinction is not one that the ANPRM tries to really eliminate, nor do I think there's any political power to shift it one way or the other.
I think they just may lack a jurisdictional hook, right? You know, if they're not giving the funding, how could they have a claim on these private organizations, right? So the FDA's jurisdictional hook is that you're creating a regulated product. OHRP's regulatory or jurisdictional hook is that you're getting federal money. These private entities that are not generating an FDA-regulated product and are not getting federal money are just sort of outside the Venn diagram completely. Now, that doesn't mean, let's put the Facebook example aside because I know people feel really strongly about what happened there. This doesn't mean that private companies who are doing research are, you know, acting nefariously or doing something wrong necessarily, but it is helpful to have a body like an IRB or just basically another set of eyes evaluating whether you're treating the participants in research, however it's funded,
yes,
fairly, appropriately, and thinking about their confidentiality and other protections like that.
Biospecimens in particular, but all data, I think the other big change socially outside of the research is the whole concept of de-identified as a past tense and something that is done has come under a lot of attack. So there is the Jimrex study, which I think really opened a lot of people's eyes on genetic material. But in general, I think when I talk about this, and Holly, we have never talked about this, so we'll see what she thinks. When I talk about this, I say anybody who uses the term de-identified as if it's a completion of a process is probably misleading you, that this is a continuum of how de-identified your data is. But for the most part, the only data that's truly de-identified is data that's relatively useless. And I think that once we adopt that paradigm and realize that it's not as though there is a way to completely de-identify data, now I think kind of the whole game plan of how to deal with biospecimens and data in general looks a little bit different than it did in an earlier era where people, I think, were comfortable thinking that if you strip these identifiers, it really was de-identified.
Yes.
That's why the ANPRM goes the direction it goes, I think, which is to say what the ANPRM suggests is as opposed to the current regulatory structure in which you could use existing specimens and data that have been de-identified and not have that count as human subjects research. Under the ANPRM's regime, that would count as research, but what you would need is sort of one-time future consent for how those could be used. And so I think that kind of tries to split the baby in a way, recognizing that it's not completely de-identifiable, so we ought to ask people what they want to have happen. I can put in a shameless plug for another event that Glenn and I are organizing at the Petrie Swan Center, along with collaborators Sue Rivera at Case Western and Barbara Bierer at Harvard Catalyst. So on November 16th, we're going to be hosting an event here at the law school focusing on exactly these questions. What's the appropriate way to regulate and use specimens and data for research purposes? So we're going to cover the gamut from, you know, collecting, storing, using, sharing, all of these types of things, because it's an area of tremendous interest and difference of opinion, I think.
And I'll also say that even in the book itself, there's actually a wide variety of opinions on biospecimens, and they go in both directions. So Ellen Clayton, for example, she thinks that the ANPRM treats biospecimens as per se identifiable, and that's a problematic. And she thinks that we're drawing too much distinction to biospecimens as special, right? There's also people who think that, you know, questions of ownership of tissue, which we dealt with in the law and we continue to deal with, that these are something that marks biospecimens as separate from other kinds of data or information that might be useful. And as you say, the history with the Havasupi tribe, with Henrietta Lacks, certainly I think in the mind of the public, there is something special or exceptional about having pieces of you. But our colleague David Korn is fond of saying, you know, pieces of people are not people, as he puts it, right? The idea that we are imbuing specimens of ourselves or portions of ourselves with the rights of personhood. So I see this as an area where the ANPRM has waded in, but there really is a huge amount of disagreement, even at the level, I think, of first principles.
Yeah, I think that's right. Sue Rivera has a chapter in our book as well, and Yeah, I'm just thinking back to her presentation at our conference even, where she basically says, look, people are sharing information about themselves left, right, and center, right, on Facebook and Twitter and, you know, Instagram or whatever else it is. Do we really need to be so protective of their privacy in research if they're not that protective of their privacy?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really fascinating question of, frankly, research exceptionalism, which is something Glenn and I talk about a lot. Why are we treating research as something that's so special and different from things that people, you know, otherwise do and are not so heavily regulated or overseen?
So our fundamental definitions of research are shifting, along with our definitions of the nature of protections and the nature of the identifiability of data, all of which are concepts that have been accepted as and standardized as they are described in the regulations. And our conversation now in this era of human subjects protections is so interesting because we're seeing those morph a bit. And I think one of the most interesting definitional changes that we're seeing, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems to me that the very definition of what it means to be a research participant is also changing, especially as the research participant is becoming, in biobanking, a more active part of the research process. And we're beginning to engage in questions of when and how the results of research should be returned to participants, things of that nature. So do you think that some of these changes in policy and practice include a change in what it means to be a research participant? And how would you describe that change?
Yeah, we could talk about the Cori in a moment and other things like that. I'll start just at the level of linguistics. So when I was being taught this material and taught about human subjects research, I was always taught in the rubric of human subjects. And now it's much more common to talk about participants. There is a split, I would say, among bioethicists who work in this area as to whether they think the term participant is misleading in a sense, that it's selling a certain kind of role and a certain kind of relationship, whereas subject might be the more appropriate term, both in terms of the degrees of freedom of the individuals involved, but also almost telegraphing not really a fiduciary, but fiduciary-lite relationship between the researcher and the subject. We protect subjects. We work with participants. So I think even just the shift in the linguistic formulation has been interesting. And some people say, no, subject sounds like slavery, right? This is exactly what we don't want to be, where other people think they're overselling the amount of participation.
I couldn't agree more with that. It's something that I struggle with myself, and probably even on this conversation, I've talked interchangeably about subjects and participants. And so if I'm just all for accuracy, right? If a person who is involved in research is truly actively participating and shaping the research, really engaging the investigators, basically what we would describe as true community-based participatory research, that's appropriate. Call them participants. Otherwise, I think it is more appropriate to refer to people as subjects. And I know that there's some discussion in the community about whether we should just call everybody participants sort of aspirationally, right? Because that's where we would want to get to. I think that's a little bit worrisome if we're not there yet. It sort of acts like, I think it looks like more window dressing. You're calling people participants but not really engaging with them as such. If we have, at least for, you know, autonomous, competent adults who are actively participating with investigators, what do they need to be protected from? I think that's a real question. And if we have IRBs as another layer of protection, it may not be necessary as we move towards that new paradigm.
I'll also say that I think, so, you know, William Gibson once said the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed.
Yes.
There are some subcommunities, and I think in particularly here of neglected diseases or really tightly banded diseases groups like autism, I think of patients like me, where I think participant really does mean something. The people involved, their names appear on the paper in some form. They're involved with generating the data, with suggesting hypotheses, right? There really is kind of a thick community.
Yes.
There's others, though, where I really think that what you want your participation to be at, it's the level of having the designated community member on the IRB who kind of, you know, is sits there around all the white coats and maybe feels intimidated in some instances. And they're involved in helping you figure out how to retain, how to recruit from this community. And there they have their usage. But beyond that, when it comes to research design and choices like that, they're being pulled for the reaction. They're not in the driver's seat. So I do think there really is these two worlds. And, of course, the PCORI funding stream is meant to push us in the world towards involving more participants. But the funding stream is relatively recent, and, you know, it's unclear to me how successful it's going to be, especially, in my view, in the more corporatized subsectors of human subjects research. So I think of particularly FDA-regulated therapeutics, where so much of the design is kind of dictated by an outside entity. And the mistakes you can make in running your trial wrong have huge ramifications in terms of the bottom lines of these companies.
My thought was more related to what you mentioned about the community members on IRBs. And I think there's a fundamental question about who counts as a representative of the community and who can sort of stand in when we're talking about patient participation in research. Obviously, you know, you're getting a subset. It's not a vote, right? You know, this is not a representational system. But I think the questions that PCORI in particular are trying to get at are which outcomes are most important to participants. And I do think that's relevant and important. The other distinction that I've seen happen is, you know, some institutions will have a community advisory board and an institutional review board, mm-hmm. and never the two shall meet, right? And it's kind of interesting that you would have both but not utilize the community advisory board. And so I think that would be a very easy fix for institutions to make if they're really serious about subjects as participants.
And in our book, in the chat, the third part of the book about the participant research of relationship and the role of IRBs, so Govind Prasad has a very interesting chapter on deliberative democracy techniques, which are often thought about like trying to decide about roads or taxation and their usefulness in the IRB process. I also know outside of our book, someone like David Winnikoff has done some interesting stuff in biobanking, the idea of trust models, so alternative governance models that are neither IRB nor are they completely top-down outside of the IRB as well, but have kind of ownership in some sense and ideas of collective ownership. And you could even see the ultimate kind of resolution of the Henrietta Lacks genome issues at NIH, where the family has been empowered, and we could talk about whether this is proper or not, with a kind of veto over the usage of some of the data and some of the specimens, and certainly the publication thereof, as a kind of governance structure that tries to get participants more involved. Why I have some qualms about that is that it's not Henrietta Lacks who's making the decision, it's her family, who, by virtue of genetic relatedness, I think do have some claim to make a decision, but it's a little tricky when you think of descendants making decisions about our biomaterials.
Yes, so it sounds like the way that the regulations describe participation in research and being a human subject is far more complicated than the simple definitions we find there let on. And at any rate, this has been a fascinating conversation. There's so much to consider here, and it's clear that this is an interesting time to be a researcher, a participant, a subject, or an IRB member, or someone even loosely related to this conversation. I really appreciate all the time that you have spent with us talking through these issues, and everyone needs to have this book on their shelf. We'll provide a link to it with the podcast as it's posted. And we also look forward to tuning in to your conversation at the Petrie Flom Center on Privacy and Genetics and Biobanking on, I think you said, November 16?
Yes, that's right, November 16th, 2015.
Excellent. Thanks again for your time. Perhaps when we have the NPRM in hand, we can talk again about what we are finally seeing there.
Sounds like a plan.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us for More Than Meets the IRB. We would like to thank the Office for Public Affairs at Washington University School of Medicine for their generous support. See you next time.